It is. Thankfully, the rain has stopped, but it is still plenty wet outside. Lying in his sleeping bag, coming awake in the cold, wet morning, he can smell the rain. The soft light on his tent flap tells him the sky is cloudy. But it feels good to be in the woods. He gets up, puts on his hiking pants and a fresh pullover shirt. He pulls the light jacket over the shirt and zips it. He needs to relieve himself. He steps into the cold boots and arches out of the tent without tying them. He walks 10 paces, and it's like stepping with cold cinder blocks on your feet. He finds an open space in the brush and starts to pee. The trees and ground are covered with last night's rain. His own warm stream spatters the low branches of a spruce. He finishes, turns back to his tent, and takes down the pack from where he had hoisted it. He opens the plastic garbage wrap, unties the top, rummages for his camp stove, retrieves it, and returns to the level rock beside the fire pit to fix himself oatmeal. His breath clouds in the early morning. He checks his watch and sees it is just after 8:30. By 9 he has heated water, filled his REI cup with instant oatmeal, mixed it over his stove, and admired the steaming ambrosia of cinnamon apple oats. While the mixture cools, he stuffs his bag and dismantles his tent. He shakes the tent fly in the dull morning light. Water droplets scatter over the camp. He does the same with his tent, shaking it before laying it on the ground on top of the fly and folding and rolling both into a compact ball. Then he stuffs it into its storage sack and tucks it into his pack. He is careful to leave room for the stove, gas canister, bowl, spoon, and cup. Otherwise, his pack is ready. After his long night in the tent, he cannot believe how good the oatmeal tastes. He wolfs down the concoction in about 2 minutes, and makes himself another batch. The day is overcast, but tolerable. "At least it's not raining," he says out loud. It is the first time he has heard anything other than the quiet of the woods and an occasional bird chirp. He is surprised by how foreign his voice sounds. He hoists the pack onto a nearby log. As he leans to get into it, he cannot help but kneel in the wet humus. The damp, rich smell comes up to him. He can feel the cold soak through his pant leg, but knows it will be fine in about 5 minutes, as soon as he is warmed by the hiking. Jason picks up the trail where he left it. It runs down to the boggy creek before rising into dense woods just 10 feet across the other side. The place where the trail crosses the bog has been reinforced by fallen logs and boulders, and he carefully wends his way across. This morning he realizes the path is not as clear or wide as yesterday's. Still, it appears to be wide enough, shooting off in a straight line through the woods. Spruce, tamarack, jack pine, and low-growth alder. Up ahead it rounds a big spruce. Wet branches extend over it, but when he pushes through, the trail on the other side is clear again. As it rounds the tree, it starts moving in a northeasterly direction that gradually bends east, but its change in direction is difficult to notice. If he had been awake at dawn, he might have noted the dull glow of the eastern sky and been troubled by the trail's direction. Now he follows the meandering path in the opposite direction from which he'd come, the wrong direction. He recalls the trail's outline on the Fisher map, how it started turning west. He suspects he turned west yesterday afternoon, well after the sky turned hazy, then overcast. He had been so preoccupied with setting up camp, building a fire, making and eating dinner. He hadn't paid attention to the sky or the direction of its last dull glow. And besides, the sky was dense and overcast, pregnant with rain. He had been comfortable watching the fire burn. Now he walks due east on the northernmost loop of the old powwow trail, believing he is walking west past Poe's Lake, starting his counterclockwise circuit of the proper powwow trail. Walking with a heavy pack in the morning can make you feel more alive than if you'd stopped at Starbucks for a venti. Despite the low weather, gray light, and wet world, Jason feels good. For the first hour of hiking, the trail is relatively clear, but almost imperceptibly it becomes overgrown. On rare occasions he parts branches, and the leftover rain grazes him like the fronds of a painter's brush, but he appreciates the pine bough's sparkle. After an hour the cloistering brush has soaked the front of his thighs, but hiking with the heavy pack keeps him warm and he enjoys himself. It isn't exactly as he imagined, He came to the powwow for a hike on an airy, wide trail bordered by solitary trees and bathed by a resplendent sun. The path is narrow and overgrown, and the sky's color is closer to unearthed bones than turquoise. But in the early morning it is still pleasant. Then up ahead the path seems to disappear into some black spruce and alder. Jason forges ahead, looking behind him to remember the direction of the path he has already passed over. He pushes through the thick brush and comes out on the other side, and finds it. He locates the narrow path, little more than a game trail, but still clear through the woods. He continues walking. In another 15 minutes the same mysterious path disappearance occurs. And his remedy is the same. He pushes through, around the wet brush. His pack catches on the branches, and he struggles forward. He turns the corner of a spruce. The path reappears clearly through the trees, and he keeps walking. It is much narrower here. Branches line both sides of the meager trail, swatting the outer reaches of his backpack as he passes. He continues hiking, trying to avoid getting lashed, and then the path peters out entirely. Damn, he thinks. But twice he has lost the path, only to push through brush and recover it. He forges ahead. He plows through more brush. The branches snap back behind him. He dodges left to move around a large popple. He steps to the right to avoid boulder rubble. He pushes forward, stepping carefully over mottled roots, but after several minutes, he still hasn't recovered the path. And here he turns around to consider where he has arrived. All around him the branches are thick. He stands in the middle of an unbroken patch of wood, with almost no room for movement, no visible way around or through the brush, and he is startled by the dense wall. He laughs, but it is a pallid humor. He has to take a picture of this. It is so foreign, so random, so unlike anything he has ever seen, so apparently impassable. And yet here he is, in the center of it. He reaches into his jacket pocket, pulls out his disposable camera, and snaps a shot of the woods. In the foreground, his lens is randomly framed by a couple of spare alders, barely taller than himself. More low-growth alders dot the landscape, intermingled with small 6-foot firs. Beyond them, to the left and right, mature firs rise into an opaque sky. The picture is remarkable because clearly there is no path ahead of him, to the left or right. And when he turns around, there is more of the same behind. He's flummoxed. He turns again to try and figure out which way he should walk. He feels certain the trail is 50 feet behind him. He decides to recover it and check his direction. Jason bends and pushes through the swale the same way he came in. Then he hikes back, recovering his direction. But 50 feet doesn't recover anything. He is still in the middle of the wood, with no discernible path in any direction. He shakes his head. For the first time he feels a dull edge of panic, as though someone has placed the backside of a blade against his stomach. He turns around. Through the thick brush of trees he sees a sparkle. He can barely discern the pleasant reflection of dull sky off water. He pushes toward it and sees the edges of a lake. It is the first big water he has seen since yesterday's crossing of the stream near Isabella Lake. Last night he assumed he camped near Poe's Lake. He remembers it is the only lake in the vicinity, and he remembers it has islands. According to his fisher map, it has one large island and two smaller ones, which he should be able to see from the bank. And if he is right about Poe's Lake, he is close to the trail. It would only take a little more bushwhacking to recover it. He hikes forward to investigate. When he reaches the bank, his view of the rest of the lake is blocked by a wooded peninsula. He moves 50 yards along the shore until he stands at the peninsula's edge and stares over the open water. Nothing. Nothing except water, and the clear border of lake shore surrounding it. There is another tug, lower in his stomach. He finds a clear place to take off his backpack. The woods have crowded him, providing resistance as he fought his way to the lake's edge. Though he hasn't been hiking for much more than an hour, it's around 10 o'clock. He still feels like taking a rest and trying to figure out his location. When he consults the map, he doesn't find anything resembling the apparent shape of this lake. He starts to worry, but only a little. He remembers the path behind him, how it was relatively clear and close, and he suspects he should be able to recover it easily enough. And of course, once recovered, he will continue. Jason remembers times in the past when he's been hiking and gotten lost. Those times he could always recover the trail. He always retained a general sense of direction, of the way he should be hiking. And every other time he has been able to recoup his trail, find his way back, his way out. But those were in southern woods and state parks, where trails are as prevalent as a rat's maze, and where the park has clear, close boundaries, not to mention being surrounded by roads. These woods, he reflects, are entirely different. This forest is on an entirely different scale. The boundary waters is over 1,000,000 square acres, purposely void of any of the usual markings or signs. Still, he thinks he has a good idea of not only where the trail is, but the direction he should be hiking. He hoists his backpack and starts hiking in the direction from which he came. For about an hour, he pushes through the woods. The branches rise up like a series of flexible walls. He pushes through one wall, and behind it, there is another green lattice of fir branches and low-growth alder, and behind that, another. On occasion, there is a small opening, and he takes it, continuing to move in the direction his instincts dictate. This isn't Jason's idea of a pristine hike in the woods. He fights the entire way, getting wetter the more he pushes through damp brush. And the woods are thick. They are thicker than anything he's been through down south. There is nothing fun about hiking through wet woods in October. The air is crisp. It is barely above freezing. The sky is overcast, and Jason continues to ruminate on how hard it is to bushwhack through dense forest. He has never seen anything like it. He is worried, but not yet distraught. He knows the direction, believes he will recover the path. And when he does, he finally concedes. He is going back home. He is going to return to his car, head down to the North Shore, have a bite to eat, and go home. He is tired of the struggle. This is very different from what he imagined. If he had found a better trail, more clearly marked, and been able to locate the appropriate campsites over Pose Lake, and if the weather had been better, then things would have been different. But as it is, walking in wet woods in October with a 50-pound pack on your back is tiring and frustrating, not exactly on most people's list of leisurely fall activities. Another branch lashes his pack, swings back behind him, and he stumbles forward. And finally, he is rewarded. He crosses the path. It is clear, straight, obvious. Thank God! He feels a momentary rush of relief. He stops for a minute, looking in both directions. He gets out his compass, holds it flat, and waits for the needle to resolve itself. Jason thinks he is at the top of the Powwow Trail Loop, somewhere near Pose Lake, where he camped last night. By now he may have hiked well west of the Pose Lake Spur. He believes he has recovered the east-west trail. Now, if he really wants to return, he suspects he will have to hike east. He looks at the needle. This section of the trail moves in a west-southwesterly, east-northeasterly direction. Jason gets out his map and has another look. He knows he is somewhere near the top of the loop. He knows he must be close to Post Lake. It is not necessary he finds the lake, though it would be a good verification of his position. Still, he is almost certain he's at the top of the loop. To return to his car, he will have to continue east along the trail. He puts away his map and compass and starts walking east, exactly opposite the direction he should be hiking. The trail is reasonably clear. It is a lot like the trail he crossed this morning before he lost it. It moves in a relatively straight line, and for the first 20 minutes, whenever he loses it in the trees and brush, he comes out the other side and recovers it. He keeps walking, hiking along the trail, pushing through the deep woods. His mind wanders to his car's interior. He sees the Saturn where he left it in the lot. He sees himself taking off the burdensome pack. He finds his keys, remembering where he stowed them. He opens the trunk, drops his pack in, comes around to the front seat, and starts the engine. In 5 minutes, moving along the gravel roads, the inside of the car heats up like a warm blanket. He is tired, and by the time he reaches his car, he reasons he's going to be dog-tired. But it is going to be a sweet reunion. He can feel the way the car heats up and makes him drowsy. He will have to stop and get some coffee, maybe in Finland. With luck, it will only be early afternoon. Still plenty of time to get back to Highway 61, have an early dinner along the North Shore, and return home. Jason pushes through more woods. He has to constantly look down, watching his feet. One misstep and he could be in a world of hurt. This would be no place to break an ankle or twist a foot. He steps carefully, lost in his warm car daydream. After 2 hours of fighting through the woods, he pauses, knowing he should be closer to where the path opens up. Then he looks up and realizes the path has again disappeared. He has been looking down at his feet so long, not paying attention, struggling to get through the next section of brush, that he has lost the damn path again. He can't believe it. A percussive cry gives voice to his frustration, loud enough to silence the red squirrels and ruffed grouse for at least a 50-yard radius. He turns around, trying to recover the trail, trying to decide which way to move. And then he sees it. There is a clear sparkle of water through the dense branch weave. At first he thinks it could be Post Lake, but by now, hiking this long, he should be much farther east than Post Lake. And there is something about this water, the way it shimmers through the branches, that is eerily familiar. He cannot put his finger on it, but he suspects the airy tumult in his stomach is because this scene, the sparkle through the branches, looks so similar to the water he saw earlier this morning. He takes a few more steps toward the lake. He looks at the water, peering through the branches. And then it hits him, not in a pleasant way or with mild surprise. It hits him like someone placing a well-positioned fist in the center of his abdomen. Christ, he thinks. It's the same lake. I'm in the exact same spot I was in 2 hours ago. Something like a slow-burning panic starts to unravel him. Now he is genuinely scared. When he thinks about how far he's hiked, pushing through the damp woods for the last 2 hours, hiking in some kind of big circle that has brought him back to his exact point of departure, he's dumbfounded. It is like some kind of science fiction movie in which the universe is confined to the narrow reaches of a wild wood, and there is no way out. He is condemned to walk in huge circles through wet woods. He laughs to think about it, how it could be some writer's sense of hell. Only there is no humor in his laugh. Get hold of yourself, Jason whispers quietly in the dense woods. And after several minutes he manages to calm himself, his disappointment. Of course there's a way out. He pushes to the edge of the lake to make sure, and there is the tree-covered peninsula, the same one he observed this morning. There is absolutely no doubt he is near the exact place he stood this morning, contemplating this very same lake. He looks at his watch. Almost noon. He is not happy, but he knows he has to sit down, take off this heavy pack, and reconnoiter. He's not yet ready to ask himself, what's the worst that can happen? For the time being, he focuses on getting out of these woods. 8. Bugs and Backwaters. South of the Man Chain of Lakes, Quetico Provincial Park, Thursday, August 6, 1998. During the interminable night, Dan Stevens lies in the dark and struggles to breathe. The shelter is tight and warm enough, but he has not reckoned on the bugs. Mosquitoes swarm over his exposed skin. He suspects they were nestled in the grass when he cut it. Lying in the tight enclosure, covered by the thick rushes, he is hounded by the pests. He alternates breathing through his nose and mouth. He cannot help but inhale them. There is a dry, metallic taste in his throat. He has learned to swallow and snort, but when he realizes the tinge of copper on his tongue is from his own blood, panic forces him to wiggle out of his tight lean-to and take refuge in the cold. Outside it is cool and relatively bug-free. He tries to normalize his breathing. He spits and takes another draft of water. But he is not dressed well enough to stay out long. Dan knows he cannot afford the expenditure of energy required to shake and shiver. He drinks water. He waits. He has a powerful headache and still feels woozy. But this much he knows. To survive, he is going to have to climb back into that bug-infested den and lie down in darkness. He's going to have to separate himself from the reality of it. There is no chance of sleeping. A kind of distant rest is the best he can muster. Finally, When the cold is becoming too great, he wedges himself back into his seething cocoon. And the mosquitoes, apparently warmed by him, apparently attracted to his heat, continue to feed on their meaty course. If it was any other time, any other place, and he had any other recourse, he would rip out of his makeshift shelter and run screaming through the woods. Several times the swarms bring him near hysteria. The effect of so many needles burying themselves in his open skin, the taste of them in his mouth and throat, some of them engorged with his blood. He manages to hold it at the far reaches of consciousness. He knows if he lets them in, if he thinks about it, considers the pestilential siege, his slight hold on sanity may waver. He is coherent enough to remove himself mentally from the debilitating swarm. He tells himself it is only one night, this night, the longest of his life. He lies in the boggy grass near the beaver pond, wondering where he is. Consciousness is shallow and fitful. When he rises and seeks refuge in the open, he is keenly thankful for the one good thing about the cold. It makes the bugs docile as pet rats. When he kneels to drink, he knows he is still sluggish from the fall. He remembers leaping across a pile of stone and falling. He sees a ragged field of stone as though it is part of some dreamscape. He remembers his friends from Chattanooga. He has a pounding headache, but through it he still worries about them. He waits until the cold drives him back into the warmth of his shelter. He lies quietly and tries to drift again into half-sleep, waiting for the first gray light of dawn. His body is one big itch. The previous day's abrasions have left his legs sore and aching. Before lying in the grass, he debated taking off his tennis shoes. But he appreciated their protection against bugs, and didn't want a scavenger to mistake them for a meal. And besides, if he wants to walk out alive, his shoes are almost as important as water. Finally, he decided to leave them on. Now, in the first hazy light, he wiggles his toes, and they feel hot, as though sunburned. Trench foot, he guesses. He suspects he'll be walking in pain. He lies still, waiting for the woods to lighten. When he can see well enough to move through brush, he crawls out from under his makeshift shelter. He is tired, but thankful the long, dark, grueling pestilence is behind him. He pisses, and mosquitoes rise to the warm stream, but in the early morning cold they are sluggish and easily swatted away. He is relieved to finally be out of their clutches, at least for now. Now he must move to stay warm. Until the sun rises, the bugs will be tolerable. In the muted light, he looks down and finds the hefty walking stick he trimmed the night before. He notes the direction in which it is laid. He uses it to mark what he thinks is a southern trail across the half-lit marsh. Then he leans over and picks up the pine pole. It feels good to grip, something to hold on to. He walks up to the edge of the beaver pond, finds a clear place to siphon water, and fills his collapsible canteen with enough for a good morning draft. The bugs are starting to warm to him. He drinks quickly, forcing the water down. He looks to the growing light in the woods and rechecks his position by guessing at the direction east. He is still groggy, but coherent enough to know if he wants to get warm, he had better start moving. He knows Summer's canoe base lies somewhere south. He takes a vague bearing in that direction and strikes off through the trees. Believing they are out of range for the proper operation of their radiophone, the fathers rise at first light. Tim awakens Sean so they can return over the portage and check the dark cave of cedars where Stevens disappeared. Jerry Wills will let the other scouts sleep a little longer. They are going to need their rest. It was a hard evening and night, and today they will be asked to do the impossible, to find their way through a maze of lakes they have never seen, locate and cross more than a half dozen unmarked portages, some of them long, and paddle 27 miles to find a ranger station on the international border. Wills switches on a flashlight and stares at the map. He doesn't know how they can do it, but he doesn't see much choice. The life of their guide and friend and their own lives might depend on it. His hand reaches up again to rub his sternum where his chest feels tight. The strain, he knows. The hard physical labor of paddling and portaging. Still, he wonders about his heart. Maybe he should have it checked when he gets home. This part of the Quetico is rugged, with prominent outcrops and high granite ridges. Jerry Wills recalls Dan describing the man chain, wondering if the region's unusually high ridges might render their radio phone useless. The terrain, their concern about schedule and direction, and the vague discomfort they all feel when contemplating a return through the nameless lake, convinces Jerry Wills they have made the right decision. To stay together, keep moving ahead, continuing southwest, hoping they will encounter another group, or at least make it far enough so their radio phone is operational. Finally, Jerry Wills looks up to see Tim and Sean's canoe disappear into the northeastern shadows of Bell Lake. He turns and starts waking his crew. In the early morning, Tim and Sean retrace the portage to peer over No Name Lake. They carry a small cache of supplies, some food and waterproof matches, a note for Dan detailing their return for help. "Stay put," the note concludes. "We'll be back with help." They lay Stevens's cache on the No Name Lake side of the portage. The portage is dim, but the path is clear. They are surprised that yesterday they couldn't find it. They peer over the nameless lake. The water is calm. The only sign of their crossing are footprints in the muddy transition between lake and dry land. None of them are Dan's. To look back over the lake where their friend and guide disappeared makes them feel anxious. This far into wilderness their imaginations are unbridled. They picture wolves, bears, cougars, or things more sinister. They call out in the early light, but there's no response. Pondering Dan's disappearance makes their skin rise like a plucked chicken's. They call again. Nothing. They repeat their call, waiting for some response, but there is only the warm mist rising in half-light over the deceptively placid water. They wonder what could have happened, shaking their heads, bewildered. The invincible Dan Stevens walked into the woods and disappeared. What in hell could have happened to him? "Let's get back," Tim finally says. Sean couldn't agree more. The day is warming, but the bugs have not yet started to swarm. They turn and recross the portage, paddling the short distance to camp. By the time they reach it, the others are nearly loaded and ready. Jerry Wills has been careful to pair their supplies to absolute essentials. In spite of park regulations, discarded equipment and food sits near Dan's tub at the edge of camp. Jerry reminds himself that today they have to make time. The park has a zero-footprint policy. Visitors are not to leave any traces of their presence. But this is an emergency. They will inform the rangers at Prairie Portage, and someone will return for it, providing bears haven't found it and feasted. They don't want to leave these supplies, but neither had they wanted to lose their guide and have to travel at a breakneck pace for help. Jerry Wills knows they will need every possible advantage. They give one last call into the tree line, screaming Dan Stevens' name. Some of the scouts whistle, but it is early, and their efforts echo back empty. None of them expects an answer. In the distance they hear a loon cry. A lone blue heron rises in startled flight from the opposite shore. The scouts come down to the water's edge. Jerry Wills and Tim Jones take one last tour of camp. Some of the scouts are starting to climb into their canoes, readying themselves for the long journey south. "Wait a minute," Jerry Wills calls to them. The spit of rock in front of their camping site juts into the lake. It makes a long, shallow reef, descending gradually toward the middle of Bell. Their canoes are beached on a crevice running up into camp. Now the scouts gather near the lake shore. Jerry Wills comes down and walks into the water. "We need to ask for help," he says. The scouts know their troop leader. He is a devout man, always ready with a prayer. This morning he has them walk down into the water with him. Tim Jones follows them into the cold, placid lake. They huddle there, join hands like a team preparing for a big game. But there is a somber quality to this gathering. They are starting an arduous day's journey, and they're anxious, wishing they were breaking camp under different circumstances. Dan's absence hangs over their heads like a thick fog. Jerry Wills's prayer is brief, ardent, strained. He asks for God's guidance and help through the long day's journey. He asks that God watch over them and give them strength for what they are about to begin. He asks that he watch over their friend, guide him, and bring him safely home. The boys are used to their leader's words, but this morning they ring with special urgency. Before, their requests for God's blessings were general, maybe even typical, given their adventure. Today, the boys and Tim Jones murmur with Jerry Wills, sincere in their entreaties. They close with a collective amen and break silently for their canoes. "We have to get nearer," Jerry Wills finally says, thinking about their phone, worried about the long portage and paddle in front of them. "Let's cross into other man and give it another try." Dan Stevens fights through alder, cedar, black ash, and tamarack. As the day heats up, the bugs rise to meet him. He pushes through the muck of lowland swamps, struggling to find a clear rise. For most of the morning, he wanders through a marsh, vaguely aware that he needs to move south, needs to keep hiking, following the drainage. He believes if he follows the drainage, it will empty into the man chain, and eventually he'll pick up a passing canoe group, maybe his own. Twice he rises to tree-covered outcrops, thankful for the light breeze and marginally better view. He still feels groggy. He knows he has to keep taking water. Whenever he finds a clear pool or light-running stream, he kneels to drink. The rangers at the Cache Bay station told him the Quetico waters are high this year, and for that he is thankful. He develops a rhythm, walking through the brush. He uses the pine pole alternately as a walking stick and parting tool. When he is walking through thick brush, he swings the bottom tip out and under limbs, branches, or grass. Then he parts them by swinging his hand and holding the stick wide to the right or left as he passes. Sometimes he fashions a second stick from wilderness windfall. In thick areas, he uses two sticks to part whatever lies in front of him. But he is careful to keep his head up, periodically scanning for the next best landmark toward which to move. He wants to be able to see anything that rises in front of him before it becomes a problem. And he struggles to keep hiking in a southwesterly direction through brush that sometimes appears thick as a living room wall. On this day, he begins noticing bear scat, some of it moist. When hiking in Appalachia, Dan encountered plenty of bears. He prefers to let them know he's coming. Twice in the past, he has surprised a mother bear with cubs and was able to back away from the snarling she-bear. He would prefer avoiding any confrontation in these woods, so far from any hope of assistance and in such tight quarters. Truth is, the day is almost a carbon copy of yesterday, with a few notable exceptions. He is lost, hungry, tired, muddle-headed, and not entirely sure where he is or which way is south. His feet ache, and he is damn hungry. He cannot ever remember being this hungry. He feels his stomach tighten. He comes to a tiny circular island in the sea of grass and water, about 10 feet in diameter. He has a small binocular lens. He gathers some grass and kindling, and tries to use his lens to focus the sun into a fiery laser point. But after several minutes, he hasn't even produced a smoky wisp. He doesn't consider fire by friction. He's had experience with the technique, and knows that without a good hand socket, something he doesn't have the materials to build, rubbing sticks together is a useless, blistering endeavor. He was hoping a small fire would raise his spirits. If he fed it long enough, others might see it at night or see the smoke. Now he abandons the idea, gets up, keeps moving. For the scouts, the remaining mile down Bell Lake is a relatively easy paddle. From the narrow point of its southwestern end, they hurriedly cross a shallow 21-rod portage into another nameless lake. The cool morning air quickens their efforts. Once in the smaller lake, they need to hug the left shore, turning south. It is a half-mile paddle around a point with hidden reefs. Due south of the point, there is an island with jutting trees. Surrounded by a morning mist, the island looks eerie against the southern shore, but it tells them their brief 4-rod portage should be just ahead. This portage is low and marshy. The three bowmen get out and pull their canoes across the narrow 80-foot spit. They are thankful they don't have to unpack and carry. They make good time and come into another nameless spread of water, another small connecting lake. This one has a small island in the middle. They stay to the right of the island, continuing due south, searching for two jutting points of land that almost connect. They need to thread those points and cross a narrow bay to their next portage. They find the points, pass over water less than 100 feet wide, and see the south shore rise before them. From the lake, the 39-rod portage is easy to locate. The land rises up, and the path over the escarpment is clear. At this hour, they are warming to their familiar routine. They know how to divide their tasks, and their supplies and burdens are fewer. But this portage starts out with a vertical climb over a solid granite wall, as though the wilderness is throwing another obstacle in their path. The wall ends in a narrow granite ridgeback, crosses high over the water, and then plunges down the opposite side into a brief swamp before ending in the next lake. On top of the crest, Tim sets down his canoe and brings up the pack with the radio phone. Since leaving camp, they have spent more than an hour paddling and portaging. They are much higher here, and farther south. Their location might make a difference. He switches on the device. The indicator light blinks on, and the familiar, muted, white noise hums through the receiver. He tries three times, but there is no response.
"It's the distance," Jerry surmises, disappointed. "We've got to get closer."
In spite of the portage, one of the most difficult they've tackled, they work hard and fast, ferrying canoes and packs in silence. There is a small point of land that extends into the lake beyond where they enter. They glide over the water, crossing around the point to look down the long, open water of Other Man. To reach the next portage, they need to push down the lake's length. The day is warming. A light breeze rises at their backs. The lake's surface ripples, but the waves are not high enough to impede their paddling, and the wind eases their efforts. They have 2 miles of blue water and islands. On any other day, they would revel in its magnificence. They are on the north shore, the correct one for crossing. Tim Jones and his crew in the lead canoe start off along the heavy forest edge, thankful for the freshet that helps move their canoes along. They take well over an hour to paddle down the 2-mile length of Other Man. Thankfully, the portage into This Man Lake is open and easy to find. At 49 rods, the trail is longer than their first, but it is low, flat, straight, an easy crossing. This Man Lake is almost 3 times longer than Other Man. They struggle down the start of its length, hugging the northern shoreline. At 10:30, the sun is well off the horizon, and the breeze makes a small chop across the water, but they remain thankful for the wind at their backs. It is mid-morning, and Jerry Wills is tired and already strained from the paddling. When he considers his group, he thinks the boys' faces show the same signs of fatigue. Before they left the Summers canoe base, the group sat in the great hall with all the other groups and watched a video about paddling techniques and safety precautions. One section of the video showed paddlers lashing canoes together to make a flotilla and raising a makeshift sail against the wind. Jerry Wills remembers how the pair of connected canoes leaped easily across the water. It only takes the engineer a second to make the connection. This Man Lake is their longest paddle in the chain. The gust is at their backs. He thinks of the rain fly they used to stake out over camp on the few occasions the sky had darkened. It is lightweight, waterproof nylon. It would make a perfect sail. Jerry tells the group he has an idea. The boys and Tim Jones quickly buy into his plan, thankful for anything to ease the morning's labor. They have miles to paddle, and their backs and shoulders already ache with the effort. The three canoes come alongside each other. The boys lay their paddles across the gunwales and grip them, making connecting supports. Jerry Wills gets out the rain fly and lashes its corners to the bows of the 2 outside canoes. He fastens long lengths of nylon rope to the rear corners of the fly. They'll use the ropes to hold on to their fly so it can billow and capture the wind. Now all they need is a mast to raise the sail so it catches the breeze. The middle riders thrust the narrow ends of 2 paddles up into the edges of their makeshift sail. A small pocket of nylon fabric catches the wind, and suddenly the entire fly billows with the breeze. The 3-canoe flotilla surges forward. A cry of triumph goes up. From the rear of the middle canoe, Tim Jones rudders the flotilla with his oar. In this way, the small group steers down the 3-mile length of This Man Lake, skirting occasional islands in the near shore. Sometimes they skim over the water so quickly they can hear the rush beneath their canoes. They are thankful for the respite. They all wear broad smiles and cheer the rapid progress. Sometime after noon, they come to the end of the lake and are again blessed by a portage that is easy to find. There are two portages from This Man Lake into No Man Lake. The one to the east is 32 rods. The one to the west is 60 rods. While both appear flat and relatively easy to hike, the 32-rod portage will leave them with 100 more yards to paddle. Still, they prefer paddling to struggling with unwieldy canoes across uneven paths. They take the shorter portage into No Man and quickly reload their canoes. No Man is a mere half-mile crossing. On the north side of the lake, there is a campsite below a prominent ridgeline. They decide to beach their canoes at the campsite and give the radio another try. Then Tim and Justin can scale the ridgeline and hail base camp. The others will have a chance to rest and eat. Atop the ridgeline, Tim switches on the phone. There is a slight spit and crackle as the receiver turns on. Then he hears the usual white noise. He tries to raise base camp three times, but there is no response.
"Closer?" Justin asks. "That or this damn phone isn't working."
Discouraged, the two climb down off the ridgeline and join the others. They can see by the look of their troop mates they were hoping for better words.
"We need to get closer," Tim Jones says. It's an answer they all understand.
Across a lowland opening, Dan Stevens feels a light breeze. When he can see them, high pillows of cumulus drift across an azure dome. He crosses the opening to the other side and pushes through more brush. The dense weave is sometimes so thick he raises his arms in front of his face for protection. His forearms start abrading like his legs. At one point, he bends down to avoid a branch and gets poked in the eye. The scratch is watery and painful. Blinking, he struggles toward the next rise. He feels aimless in the swampy bogs south of wherever it was he stepped into the bush and kept walking. He feels desultory and lost. He thinks he is heading southwest. He positions himself by the sun. Whenever he stops to drink, he pauses long enough to peer at the sky and check his direction. He feels relatively certain he's heading in the right direction. But hiking the lowlands is like walking through a shallow hell. The bugs are pestilential. The brush is thick. And the day progresses windless and hot. And now the vision in his one eye is blurred. He still feels a huge periodic ache on the side of his head. After a 20-minute rest, he re-examines the sky. Dan double-checks his position, glances off through the trees in what he thinks is a southerly direction, and again strikes off through the bogs. Progressively, Dan Stevens comes to feel as low as the country he traverses. He has a vague notion he needs to angle toward the man chain, veered toward the possibility of finding a portage trail, and maybe staying put until the next group of scouts comes along. But he also has doubts. Before leaving the canoe base with his Chattanooga group, he had asked others about his planned route, but he could not find anyone who had made the wide circle through the BWCAW, then up through Quetico, then turning back around to come down through the man chain. He doesn't know of anyone who has come down out of the Cache Bay station in quite the same way. It could be a while before anyone else came along, and then he would be waiting on a bug-infested stretch of trail. For how long, he has no idea. He's thinking well enough to know he's not entirely lucid. An aching cloudiness hangs over him, muddling his thoughts. His vision is still blurry. He is trying to maintain his rhythm, moving carefully through the brush, parting the sharp branches with his stick, moving forward, always moving south. But he is uncertain, and through the long midday his spirits ebb to a wavering crawl. The Chattanooga group crosses the quarter-mile distance to their next portage, and this, too, is easy to find. They are blessed, but only slightly. The portage from No Man into That Man Lake is a blistering 101 rods. The climb isn't high, and the path is straight, but at over a quarter mile it is one of the longest portages they've crossed. By the time they reach the other side, they are exhausted. Back at the campsite on No Man Lake, Tim had told the group there was something more than the normal white noise, at least when he first switched the set on. Now they are keen to give it another try. Tim is doubtful, but willing. They are at lake level, but they've closed some distance. And from this vantage, the extreme length of That Man opens empty in front of them. Maybe the clear space will make a difference. He extracts the phone and flips it on. The light blinks, and the receiver sparks with more static, at least a little more than they heard on the ridgeline over No Man. Surprised, Tim presses the transmit button and speaks into the phone.
"This is group number 801C, he begins.
He releases the button, waits. The receiver is silent.
"They ain't even listening,"
one of the scouts moans.
"Quiet," Tim says.
He again depresses the transmit button.
"This is group number 801C, he repeats. "We're at No Man Lake Portage, about to enter that man. Does anybody read me?"
From the other end of the line, not even a crackle. And then the light blinks off. Tim Jones can't help himself. He cusses, says,
"Looks like it went dead."
The other scouts take the news hard. The two youngest boys' eyes start to water, and they look away, embarrassed. "We're on track," Jerry Wills finally says, trying to reassure everyone, trying to be optimistic. "Let's keep moving." Well, afternoon, Dan Stevens comes to a small stream. On the other side, the forest rises to another rocky outcrop. He kneels to drink. Tannin dyes the slow-moving water the color of dark tea. He has already crossed a half-dozen small streams like this one. He can barely see 6 inches into its murky depths. It looks shallow enough. He steps into it, expecting to hit bottom. For the second time in 2 days, his stomach registers the miscalculation before he does. He watches his foot disappear into murk. He waits for it to grip bottom. He is already too far in, with too much weight moving forward, to pause or retract his step. One leg is still on the bank, and the other disappears into the stream, and in half a hiccup he falls forward into the narrow, deep water. He plunges forward up to his neck before his feet sink into the muddy bog bottom.
"God damn it!"
he cusses, thrashing through the deep, mucky water.
"What in the hell is it going to be next?" he wonders,
struggling to reach the other side. 9. Rasmussen hikes south. North-northeast of the Powwow Trail. Tuesday, October 23, 2001. He drops the pack in a meager clearing, takes out his water bottle and drinks. He is thirsty. He's been working through these trees and he hasn't realized just how thirsty he is. He almost drains the bottle, knowing he can filter more when he needs it. He has to figure out how to recover the trail and get back to his car. He returns his water bottle to his pack's side pocket and takes out Fisher Map F4. He spreads it out before him and squints over the yellow and blue features, trying to figure out his location in relation to the trail. Lowland swamps are marked by small swatches of speckled blue. The lake water is solid blue. When he looks at the map, gazing over the top of the powwow, he thinks it could be Hush Lake. That would mean he hiked farther west than he thought, camping last night between Poe's and South Wilder Lakes. Had he wandered off the trail and headed northwest? If he were further west, could he have hiked northeast? He stares at the elevation numbers. Math and science have become Jason's strengths. Since junior college, academics have usually come easily to him. Map reading is simple. But trying to discern his own peculiar location from the myriad striations in front of him is difficult. When he gazes over the map, he assumes Poe's Lake is someplace near, within an hour hiking, tops. He gazes over the powwow circular trail and realizes he could have strayed south of the trail. He gazes south and sees Hump Lake, almost in the middle of the 26-mile circular powwow. And then he gazes even farther south, to the vicinity of the Isabella parking lot where his Saturn sits, patiently awaiting his return. He notices the forest road he used to drive here. It runs the entire length of the trail, due south of it, probably less than 4 miles. It is not exactly straight, but it's long enough so that if he hiked due south, eventually he would have to cross it. And Jason knows to miss a road would be impossible. If the bottom half of the powwow is more discernible than this top half, he should cross it long before reaching the road. When he crosses the trail, he can hike east, pick up the spur that brought him here, and be back at his car in 2 or 3 hours. And if he misses it, entirely possible given the state of the trail he's seen, he will eventually hit the road. He cannot miss a road. He fishes his compass out of his pocket, holds it flat, and lets the needle resolve itself. When he locates due south, he looks up into the impenetrable trees. It feels south. He can see himself hiking through the woods, only this time he will keep the compass out, checking it regularly to ensure his constant southerly direction. He squints again at the map. If he is near Poe's Lake, 2 or 3 miles should bring him to the bottom of the powwow. He examines the key, measuring off the distance with a finger, moving it south over the yellow terrain. If he misses the trail, he still crosses the forest road by late afternoon. And once he hits the forest road, he hikes back to his car. Either way, he is back at the car well before dusk. It's a plan, and he feels better after resting and making it. He likes using the compass, knowing his location, at least in regard to magnetic north. He is not looking forward to all that bushwhacking, but now that he has the compass out, and it will stay out, he tells himself, he won't double back on himself. He will check it regularly and keep moving due south. He gets up and hoists on his pack. He straightens the shoulder straps and shifts the weight of the pack until it's comfortable. He folds his Fisher map and decides it should be handy. The inside of his North Face jacket has a pull string he can tighten around his waist. He tucks the map inside his coat and pulls the string taut, zips his jacket shut, takes another compass reading, and then looks up. He peers into the thick brush and strikes off through the trees. For the next 2 hours, Jason struggles through difficult terrain, climbing up and over small ridges. The lower parts sometimes hold small pockets of water. He steps over them carefully, skirting boulders and rocks, tree roots, pushing through the heavy brush. The bushwhacking is difficult, but he keeps his promise to himself. He constantly checks his compass, navigating carefully through the woods. He follows the narrow point of the needle due south. He is good about maintaining his ragged direction through difficult terrain. After 2 more hours of hiking, he's getting tired. He pushes through another block of impenetrable brush. He is weary and wet. He knows if he stops longer than 5 minutes, he will start to get a chill. He pushes through the back end of the block of brush and suddenly it opens. He can't believe it. He stares across an almost 75-yard length of bog. A bog, for Christ's sake. He's stunned. Jason knows about bogs. If at all possible, you should avoid traversing them. They are deceptive islands of grass hummocks and small forest growth, and they can float over depths of water black as tea. If sphagnum lips part, if he falls through, and if it is deep enough, his death will be fast and agonizing, and the bog will swallow him whole. No one, not his parents, not rescuers, not seasoned hunters with dogs, will ever have a chance of finding even a hare. He suspects he is being overly dramatic, but he has read about bogs. He knows you're not supposed to cross them. But he has a plan, and he has promised himself he'll stick to it. He looks to the left. Maybe he can walk around it, but the bog appears to have no western or eastern edge. It looks like one large bog river, and he sees no way of maintaining his direction other than striking straight out across it. It is such a large bog he wonders if it is clearly depicted on his map. He unzips his jacket, reaches in to pull out his map, but there is nothing. He feels around the inside of his coat, around his sides, above and below the coat's waist drawstring, but the map is gone. God damn it! He lost his goddamn map! He contemplates turning around and looking for it, but realizes that in the last 2 hours he could have lost it anywhere. Finding the missing Fisher map in the thick brush he has already traversed would be almost impossible. And that's if he were certain he could hike back over the exact trail he used to get here. He remembers the map, at least most of its larger features. He remembers the trail and the way it wends over the terrain, and he still has the hiking Minnesota map. It is cartoonish in comparison, but at least it gives him some sense of the trail and the most notable lakes. He's angry at himself for losing his map, but realizes there's nothing to be done about it. He looks up and knows he has to cross this bog. He peers over the grassy hummocks. In places he can see water seeping through. It's black. He knows it is acidic, having stewed for eons in a vegetable brew. He thinks he discerns a relatively clear trail, higher than the other parts. He starts out across it, moving very carefully, one slow step at a time, testing as he moves. Before, when he was bushwhacking through dense wood, he thought he was moving slowly. Compared to how slowly he moves across the bog, his hike through the woods was a virtual sprint. He steps to one mound, testing it carefully before placing his full weight onto it. It halts. Sometimes it starts to sink like a very slow spring. But eventually, every step is solid and true. It takes him more than half an hour to cross it, stepping very slowly and carefully. Finally, he reaches the other side. He pauses long enough to enjoy a momentary sense of relief. He knows he has been lucky. He hopes he won't have to cross more bogs. He thinks he is making good progress south and expects to pass over the southern side of the powwow at any time. Providing it is wide and obvious, he reminds himself, unlike the northern part of the trail, he'll be able to take it, hike due east, and get back to his car in plenty of time. It's after 2. The skies haven't altered since he first looked up. They have been gray and thick all morning, but thankfully not weeping. If it started raining, he knows he would have to stop and set up camp, get out of the rain. Looks like it's just going to be one of those overcast days. Jason hacks his way south, attending to the bold S of his compass, letting it guide him through the boulders and thatch, continuing to push through the wet wood. He cannot remember a harder day hiking, and with 50 pounds on his back. He is going to deserve that dinner. He relishes the thought of the warm car and his drive down a wide, open road, providing he can reach it before dark. After almost 2 more hours, he still hasn't crossed the trail, but panic is a long way off. He keeps expecting the powwow to appear over the next rise, an open and obvious trail through the trees. But he also knows that he is holding to his plan, moving south, and that even if he misses the trail, he will eventually, probably before dusk, cross the forest road that brought him here. And then he pushes down a thicket slope to an edge of black spruce, and once through it, there's another bog. He can't believe it. Another goddamn bog! He does exactly what he did this morning, knowing if there is any other recourse, he should take it. He looks left. The grassy hummocks recede around a bend as though a river of moss is flowing down the contour of land. When he looks to his right, the same. It would be impossible to hike around this bog. And he remembers he is keeping to his course. He has to maintain his direction south. Deeply fatigued, he knows he is probably not reasoning as well as he should, but he suspects the trail is just the other side, waiting for him. He examines the boggy surface. He finds again what he thinks is a viable path. Thankfully, this bog is half the width of the preceding one. He steps, tests, and then moves carefully across it. In 20 minutes, he reaches the other side. Again, he breathes relief, contemplating the rise in front of him, knowing there is no other way but up. More tired than he can ever recall, he looks down at his compass and sees he is still heading due south, just as he suspected. He pushes through the heavy brush, climbs the small rise, and comes out on top. He's very tired now. He knows he should stop, but he wants to recover the trail. He feels disappointed he has not found it. The hike ahead appears clearer. Up here there is a solid granite dome covered over with caribou moss and lichen. There's some grass. And then it opens up wide and clear for at least 30 yards. As he moves forward, the clouds part. For the first time all day, a discernible blue gap opens in the otherwise gray and white cover. It's misty, but definitely blue. And then the sun breaks out, shining on Jason's small clear island in the middle of the brush. He looks up, bathing in it. If he were religious, he would interpret it as a sign. Even though he's not, he will still interpret it as a sign. He moves forward a few steps, and down the other side he sees a long lake. He doesn't remember a lake on the map. He didn't think he would be coming in contact with a lake. But this one is definitely different from the one he has already seen twice today, the one far behind him. This place, bathed in the sun over the long, narrow stretch of water, is beautiful. It is the first truly open patch of ground he has encountered all day. He revels in being unencumbered by thicket and brush.
It is almost 4 o'clock, and he knows he is far too tired to continue hiking. It occurs to him that this is the